The following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation is by Noni Darwish and is entitled God, Gaza, and Israel. For a free catalog of over 200 awesome Stealing the Mind Bible studies on DVDs, CD, or audio tape, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 or on the web at compass.org.
It is a great pleasure and honor to be in this wonderful church. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I also want to thank the American people, America, for letting me know my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Without America, I could never have known him, because I live in a country that where I came from, Egypt, and Islam does not allow you to learn anything other than Islam. You're not allowed to even touch a Bible. So I could never have known the truth without America. Thank you. I would like to start a little bit about my background. I was born actually in Cairo, and I was raised in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, because at that time in the 50s, Egypt ruled over Gaza. And my father headed the Egyptian military intelligence in Gaza. That was during the time of President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, who was committed to unify the Arab world and destroy Israel. My father headed a group called the Fida'iyin. Fida'iyin means men who wants to self-sacrifice, literal meaning. But this was a guerrilla-style warfare against Israel, whereby people penetrated into Israel, caused as much damage, destruction, and death inside Israel. Israel suffered a lot from these operations, and they wanted to end it, and they wanted to kill my father. There was a couple of assassination attempts on his life by Israel, whereby Israeli commandos came into our heavily guarded home in Gaza City. My father, by coincidence, was not home that night. All the commandos found were women and children, my mother, two maids, and us five children. The Israeli soldiers left us unharmed. When I woke up, I never even woke up that night, but I saw a truck. My mom was very upset. I saw commotion, and they took all the security personnel around our house and put them in a truck. And I knew from my mom they were being interrogated to see who's the traitor who allowed the Israeli commandos in. My favorite soldier, his name was Abdul Halim, and he used to play with us a lot. He never came back. And I learned later that he was killed during interrogation. I attended Gaza elementary schools. And we learned hatred, vengeance, retaliation. Peace was never an option. I never heard a peace song in Arabic. All the sermons in the mosques were all about jihad, never about peace with Israel. In school, we recited jihadist poetry daily. And little girls, we were like 7, 8-year-old girls, they used to cry while they were reciting poetry, saying, "I would like to die as a shaheed." That was very powerful on us children. So I lived in this turmoil of the Gaza Strip during a very, very hard time in the fighting with Israel. After 2 years of intense Fida'iyin operations against Israel, my father was actually killed by Israel. I was 8 years old. We moved back to Cairo with my mother. President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt came to our home to pay condolences. And he came in and I noticed that the whole neighborhood was looking at our house. And my mom told us, stand in a line to greet the president. We stood in line, my siblings and I. He came in with a lot of entourage with him. And the first question he asked us with his entourage, which one of you kids will avenge your father's blood by killing Jews? I remember feeling very uncomfortable with this question, and we were looking at each other, my siblings and I, which one will volunteer? None of us did. We were just speechless. This question, I remember it until today because it made me feel very uncomfortable. It made me feel if I really loved my father, then I would want to, I should kill Jews. I should hate Jews. So after my father's death also, my mom had to face life alone with five children in a culture that gave respect only to families headed by a man. My mom had to buy a car because she was used to having a car with my father. Very few women in Egypt drove cars in the 50s. And I remember my mom one day, she was crying and saying, the neighbors are calling me names. They're calling me, what kind of a loose woman would go buy a car after her husband dies? And I remember her saying, isn't it enough that Arab women are expected to sacrifice their husbands and their sons to the jihad? But they are never given respect to live their lives with dignity and with some freedom. So this is an Islamic country. I mean, it is a Muslim country, and women are very restricted from doing many things without a man. When the West Bank and Gaza were in Arab hands, their economy and infrastructure were neglected completely by the Arab world. And it's not because the Arab world couldn't afford it. The Arab world certainly could afford building hospitals, schools, universities, factories in those two regions. But it was neglected. They didn't build roads. 22 Arab countries did everything they could to make life impossible for Israel to exist. And I don't understand how this country survived and thrived. It must be God's protective hand over Israel. That this tiny nation could survive. The Arab League policy, the Arab League is like the United Nations of the Arab world, had a policy that Palestinians, Arabs who live in the West Bank and Gaza, should never be absorbed by the Arab world. They must be left in a permanent refugee status. And they have been living in a refugee status for 60 years. They pushed them against the borders of Israel and prevented them from taking the citizenship of other Arab countries. For example, a Palestinian could be born in Cairo or Damascus, but never get the citizenship of Egypt. Born and raised and died in Egypt, but never get the citizenship. And why is that? They want the numbers of Palestinian refugees to never decrease. They want it to stay the same. So they created an artificially population called Palestinians, even if they've never lived in the West Bank and Gaza. And this is done to keep the pressure on Israel. With a big population that supposedly have no place to live. Arab wealth was only directed to supporting the terror groups in the West Bank and Gaza. This is where Arab wealth from oil went. So the situation in the West Bank and Gaza was not good, but that's by design. And now they blame Israel for it. An unemployed man in Gaza had a better chance for employment if he joins Hamas or Fatah. So if you want to be employed, you have to become part of Hamas or Fatah or any terror group in the area. This is where you can be respected in the community. But those who want to have peace with Israel are called traitors, and they are hung literally in the public square and killed in the public square so everybody would see what will happen to those who want peace with Israel. But also the unemployed Palestinians who couldn't find work, and there are many of them, they stood out on in front, they formed a line for work, not on the borders with Egypt, not on the borders with Jordan. They stood for a line to work on the border with Israel, the very country they're expected to terrorize. This is the problem. The Gaza Strip now is the most densely populated tract of land in the world, and is home to 1.4 million Palestinians. About 33% of them live under United Nations-funded refugee camps. They want them to stay as refugees. The world must understand that the prosperity and economic stability of the West Bank and Gaza is not Israel's responsibility. A lot of our media, when they go and see the conditions in Israel and then cross and go to the West Bank or Gaza and say, oh, but the conditions here are not very good. But they don't ask why. This is done by design. Their conditions should be compared to surrounding Arab countries. If you compare Gaza and West Bank to Syria, to Egypt, and to Jordan, you'll find that their conditions is very comparable. But our media always compares them to Israel, which is a democracy. It's a wealthy democracy. We often hear demands on America, whether it's President Bush or President Clinton, it doesn't matter what administration it is, pressure Israel for concessions. But we never see even Western media ask Arab leaders, why aren't you pressuring Palestinians for concessions? This question is never asked of President Assad of Syria or King Fahd of Saudi Arabia or of the Egyptian president. The West presumes that everything is in the hands of America. Well, America cannot force peace in the Middle East. It can facilitate it. It can help it. But we are not, our media does not really know where the power for peace comes from. After 9/11, many Arabs found it very convenient to blame today's worldwide Islamic terrorism on the Israeli occupation. We heard many people on TV say, if it wasn't for the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, we wouldn't see Islamic terrorism. When I hear this, I feel this is a joke. What about the terrorism that happened against Israel by the Fida'iyin? And my own father led this under the Egyptian government's orders. So this was terrorism against Israel. And it happened before the 67 war and before the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Yes, there was terrorism against Israel. So they cannot now claim that the terrorism is because of Israel and because of the occupation. I lived for 30 years a bit, some in Gaza and mostly in Cairo, in oppressive dictatorships and police states. I witnessed honor killing of girls. Our maid was pregnant from the home that she lived in before. The man of the house was raping her because there is a surah in the Quran that says you can have sex with your four wives plus any slave women in your household. And many Muslim men believe that maids are slaves in your household. That maid of ours, she was killed by her father and brother. The agent who brought her to us came and said to us that her father and brother took her on, cleansed their honor. She was raped. I witnessed female genital mutilation, which is prescribed under Sharia Islamic law, the Shafi'i Sharia law. 97% in my mother's generation has undergone this kind of surgery done in the home by midwives. My mother was one of them. Many Muslim, and I also saw the impact of polygamy and its devastating effects on family dynamics. Many Muslim men only have one wife, but the damage to wife-husband relationship has already been done by the Muslim marriage contract itself. In the Muslim marriage contract, there are three spaces, empty spaces, 1, 2, and 3. A question is being asked to the husband. Please fill in the name and address of wife number 1, number 2, and number 3, if any. There is no loyalty expected from the Muslim husband under Islamic law. Only a woman should be loyal to her husband, but not the man. And so I hope that the West understands that how changing the marriage formula of one man, one woman can be devastating to society. Muslim women are suffering so much under polygamy, and I have relatives who have undergone that. It is so destructive to the family and to the children when they see their father leaving for another set of a wife and another set of children. He's like a guest in the house between several, a home or two or three. It is devastating for the family. And I remember, as a teenager, I was watching an American movie on Egyptian television, and I saw an American wedding in a church, and I saw that they are standing in front of each other, both praying with the priest, and they are committing themselves totally to one another as one flesh. That was a revolution in my mind, even though I was a young girl. And I wept to this definition of marriage, which we don't have. And my aunt came in the room, and she said, "Why are you crying?" I said, "You know, this wedding is so holy." And then she said, "We have more glorious weddings. We even have belly dancers." So she missed the point, and I couldn't express myself. But now I remember, and I know why. Because when I compared the virginity check of the Muslim girl in her wedding and the men writing the names of other wives, it's a totally, totally different dynamic of a family. It's very corrupting for the man. to feel that in time of trouble with his wife, instead of going to a counselor or going to their preacher, then he just goes and gets another wife. And that's destructive to the family. There are so many ills under Islamic laws. For example, as a Muslim, we were told to fear Jews. Fear them. That's how they made us scared, by telling us they are evil, they want to kill Arab children. And we believed it. And when you scare a child from a group of people, hatred becomes easy. Terrorism becomes acceptable. Who wouldn't want to terrorize a monster? They're monsters. But they didn't only make us fear Jews only. We feared even each other. We feared the evil eye, envy. This is a widespread belief in Muslim culture, and it is in the Quran, that a Muslim should be afraid of the evil eye of other people. There are many, many verses in the Quran that says that. Unlike Christian teaching that regards envy as one of the deadly sins, it's going to hurt the person who envies. Under Islam, envy is a curse given to you by others. It's a totally different look at envy. So the result is everyone must be on guard from other people. They have to hang these blue beads everywhere. Wear some Quranic verse about envy. And for example, a woman could come to another woman and say, oh, your baby is so beautiful. If the baby gets sick the other day, oh, it's probably Auntie Bata's evil eye. She envied my child. So it becomes a social problem. It creates distrust between people. And so there's so many layers of distrust in Islamic teachings. Many Muslims, many Americans in the West actually heard about the fatwa of death against Salman Rushdie. We all heard about it. But we don't know, what is a fatwa? What is a fatwa of death? It is a Muslim leader standing up in the mosque or on the radio and say, so-and-so did a violation under Islamic law. He is to be killed. What does this fatwa tell the Muslim population? It tells the Muslim population that any Muslim on the street can kill him, and he is forgiven under Islamic law. This is the power of the fatwa, and this is the power of Islam. The power of the Muslim preacher is he can order, or a Muslim authority, he can order, like when Ayatollah Khomeini ordered the fatwa against Salman Rushdie on radio. Salman Rushdie was not an Iranian. He's from India originally, and he lives in Britain. He's a British citizen. But why was he afraid? He was afraid because Muslims in Britain can respond to that fatwa and actually kill him. And this is allowed under Islamic Sharia law. There are three crimes under Islamic law that are allowed for any Muslims to do, to murder, and he's forgiven. And actually, he's a hero. It's killing through jihad. This is the only way you can go to heaven, killing Jews and non-Muslims. Killing an apostate, somebody who leaves Islam, who lives in America or in Europe, And that's why many Muslims in America who became Christians are looking over their shoulder. Because if there is a fatwa to kill them on the street. So we're not afraid because they're going to come and arrest us and take us to Islamic court in Iran or in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia. We're scared because some Muslim right here in America can kill us and feel he's doing God's work. That's what he's told by his preacher. And this is the meaning of a fatwa. A lot of people also don't understand there is a fatwa against non-Muslims by Islam. Every person who is a non-Muslim is under a fatwa to be killed if he doesn't convert or live as a second-class citizen in a Muslim country and pay something called the jizya, which is a penalty. It's a higher tax on non-Muslims. Non-Muslims in Egypt used to pay taxes, higher taxes, after, of course, being tortured, their ancestors, until the year from the 7th century, when Egypt became under the rule of the Arabs, until 1882. Until 1882, the Christians of Egypt had to pay higher taxes. After 82, the Ottoman Empire weakened and the British and the French moved in, and that's when minorities got some respect. There's a fatwa against Jews in a hadith by Muhammad. This is a holy hadith in Muslim scriptures. This notorious hadith is as follows. The hour of resurrection will not take place until Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. And the Jews will hide behind the rock and the tree. And the rock and the tree will say, O Muslim, O servant of Allah, this is a Jew behind me. Come and kill him. Some people in the Muslim world say the relationship with the Jews only became bad after the 1948 State of Israel was established. Well, this hadith was issued by Muhammad in the 7th century. So it's not because Israel was established. The anger by Arabs because Israel was established is because Israelis, Jews, are supposed to be second-class citizens in the Middle East, and they should never rule themselves. That is why Israel must be destroyed by the Muslims. Just like Lebanon. Lebanon used to be a majority Christian nation, the only Middle Eastern nation that was majority Christian. And what happened to Lebanon? There was a civil war between the Muslims and the Christians, and the Muslims won. And now Lebanon is majority Muslim. Not only majority Muslim, but Hezbollah is the unofficial ruler of Lebanon, one of the most notorious terror group on earth. And that is why the problem between Arabs and Israel is not really truly a problem over land. This is not, Arabs don't have a shortage of land. If you see the Arab land from the Atlantic Ocean, where Morocco is, until Persia and beyond, there is no shortage of land. Actually, outside of Gaza, I mean, the Sinai is practically very, very lightly populated. So this is a holy war against the Jews who should not rule themselves and be their own boss in the Middle East. This is the truth about the Arab-Israeli conflict. When I was about 20 years old, I was born a Muslim. I thought that this is the best religion on earth. That's why we're not allowed to learn anything about any other religion. But I had a Christian friend in Egypt. They call them in Egypt Copts. It's a very old sect of Christianity. I was at her home studying. We were studying. I was in college, and she lived very close to a mosque, and we couldn't help but hearing the sermon. And I heard at the end of the sermon the usual cursing of non-Muslims at every service. This was normal. We heard the preacher at the end say, "May God destroy the Jews and the Christians and the pagans and the non-Muslims, and we are not to befriend them, and we're not to be good to them, we're not to be kind to them." And I suddenly looked at my friend's face and I saw fear. For the first time in my life as a Muslim, I realized something was wrong with my religion. Why? It's so hateful of people, but I couldn't dare tell my friend this. I kept it to myself, but I learned from her mom later that during the Friday prayers, many Christians are scared to walk in front of the mosque because they could be killed or hurt. This was the first time ever that I discovered something's wrong in my religion. Why do we curse people at the end of every service? It's a common thing. They talk about jihad. Some preachers have their swords and bring it out in the service and say, "Let's go do jihad." This was so common. It was everywhere. Talking about violent jihad was everywhere. It was in songs, on the radio, in the mosque. It was on TV, in movies. Jews are always in the movies shown as criminals trying to kill. It's unbelievable, trying to kill little children. It's everywhere. You cannot live from birth there and come out not being an anti-Semite. So I discovered that the preaching that I was used to it, and believe it or not, if you grow up on cursing kind of preaching, it can feel and sound normal. It can feel and sound holy, because these are our leaders. How can I think they are not holy? But I started questioning things in my mind. I couldn't dare say it, because otherwise I can be punished bad if I criticize or ask questions about Islam. One of the laws of Sharia in Islam is to don't ask questions. You have to accept Islam as it is. Even non-Muslims are called filth, nagas. The Times of London reported lately that the British Muslims are being taught in British schools that non-Muslims are filth. And I immediately remembered a Quran verse, Quran 9:28. It says, "O ye who believe, the non-Muslims are unclean. O ye who believe, truly the pagans are unclean." Two or three verses, it's not just in one area of the Quran. So don't befriend them. Don't be kind to them. They are forbidden from going to our holy places because they're unclean. That's why many Arabs believe that the existence of non-Muslims on Muslim land is a desecration or an occupation. When US soldiers, at the request of Saudi Arabia, they told them, "Come help us," Saddam Hussein took over Kuwait, and he's coming down to Saudi Arabia because America doesn't want crazy men who set oil fields on fire like Saddam Hussein. They don't want him to go in Saudi Arabia, do the same thing. So they went to defend Saudi Arabia. Do you think this was met with "thank you, America" by the Arab street? No. It was met with, how dare the infidels desecrate Muslim land? Their feet are considered walking on Muslim land, especially Saudi Arabia, is a desecration. And this is the dynamic that a lot of people in the West don't understand. Why do they hate us so much? Because the Quran tells them so. Their holy books, their holy scriptures tell them so. They don't want to be rescued by infidels. And that's how the West is perceived. In the Judeo-Christian culture, they say, and this was something I heard in the church when I first came to the United States, and it was a revolutionary idea. Something that most Christians probably take for granted. We are all sinners. To me, that was a revolution. Oh my God, the Christian says we are all sinners? Because in Islam, we say they are all sinners. We are Muslims. We are perfect. We are Muslims. They are the sinners. In Islam, non-Muslims are called the dreaded derogatory word called kafir. Muslim scriptures are full of calls condemning non-Muslims to doom. It's almost in every verse, give them doom. It's obsessed with the non-Muslims. If you read the Quran, it's totally concentrated on the people who don't belong to us, not on the people who are Muslims. It's totally focused on non-Muslims. They focus on their degradation, on their humiliation, and their murder. And thus, Islamists have given themselves the right to force Islam on such sinners, even if it's against their will, through the principle of jihad. So this is the principle of jihad in Islam. Don't believe the people who go on TV and say, after 9/11, jihad means an inner struggle. I've never heard that meaning. I lived in the Middle East for 30 years. I never heard that meaning. Never. And I was a journalist in the UK. That's the only way a Muslim is guaranteed heaven. According to a member of the Egyptian parliament, in 2006, his name is Ragab Hilal Hamida. In a magazine in Egypt, he was interviewed and he said, they reported him saying, from the floor of the Egyptian parliament, he said the following, the Quran directly commands us to commit terrorism, so why are we afraid of it? And he started quoting Surah 8, verse 16, all the surahs that say, go terrorize them. The word terrorize was used in the Quran. And he said, I support Bin Laden, I support Zawahiri and Zarqawi, because, you know why he said he supports them? Not because I value their ideology, I agree with them, they're holy men. No, no, no. He said, because they are a thorn in the back of America. And that's a quotation from a member of the Egyptian parliament. In an August 06 conference in Pakistan, there were songs constantly about jihad will continue till the day of judgment. Jihad will never stop. So what they are telling you here on American TV is not what they are saying there. Muslim clergy, those sheikhs and ayatollahs and imams, have failed miserably in stabilizing their society. Instead of being a source of comfort and wisdom and stability in their society, they have become a source of hate, rage, and subversion. To them, in the mosque, the solution for them is always an intifada, a coup d'etat, an assassination against a more democratic leader. Or violence on the streets. A lot of people don't know that all the cartoon, the Danish cartoon violence that happened on Friday after the Friday prayer. People coming out of mosques. That's how it happened. Those preachers have no respect to legitimacy of any government. And no government is Muslim enough for them. Not even Saudi Arabia. In this dynamic and in this atmosphere, only tyrannical governments can survive. And leaders who want peace with Israel, who want reform, who want democracy, they get killed. An example is President Anwar Sadat. He signed a peace treaty with Israel, and what happened? He was assassinated. There are so many hadiths in the Quran and surahs about fighting here. Fight those who believe not in Allah until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Quran 9:5 ordered Muslims to slay the unbelievers wherever you find them. Surah 47:4. When you encounter the unbeliever, strike off their heads. This is everywhere. It's even in Sharia, Islamic law. A Muslim leader, one of his main duties under Sharia, under Islamic law, is to do jihad against neighboring countries that are not Muslim countries. He is to do jihad against them. It is in Sharia, Islamic law books, in all of them. So they say it's an inner struggle, but no. 97% when the word jihad is mentioned in the Quran, it immediately refers to violence and killing. 97%. Only 3% in the Quran, it says it is a higher jihad. We never used to hear about it, but it's 97% of the time. How can the Arabs have peace with Israel with the religious scriptures saturated with commandments to kill, hurt, annihilate, destroy the Jews? How can it happen? It's impossible. There is even a surah, a Quranic surah number 47:35. It says the following, so do not weaken and call for peace when you are superior in the war. It actually orders Muslims not to weaken, you know, and call for peace and put the white flag. If you're on top, don't accept peace. If the other party says peace, keep on going, keep on killing them. It's in the Quran. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, we have what we have, worldwide Islamic terrorism. Israel is just the front line of Arab jihad. It is, after 9/11, this is a very important story. I was devastated. I ran to the phones. I wanted to call many Egyptians. I wanted them to tell me this has crossed the line, especially after I learned that the head of 9/11, Muhammad Atta, was from Cairo, the same city I came from an upper-class, educated family. Each and every person I called, instead of comforting me, they all said the same thing. How dare you say this? Don't you know this is an Israeli-Jewish conspiracy? It's the Jews that did 9/11. They all ran from the building. All the people who were running from the building were the Jews. I hung up the phone and I felt extremely, extremely sad for the Jewish people. The Jews that we describe in our mosques, in our Arab textbooks, and in our media, and in our holy books don't exist. They are a creation of our own imagination. Islam needs an enemy to conquer. The monsters we are describing are not the Jews. We Arabs are fighting an imaginary Jew. Israel is not perfect. No society is perfect. But the way the Jews and the Christians treated them and other minorities, even the other minorities in the Middle East, the way they are treated by my people is tragic and a disgrace, and it should never happen, especially under a religion. Islamists are giving themselves the right to do what they're doing in New York, in London, in Madrid, all of these places. Because what they say when they arrest some of them, when they interview them, is God ordered me in my scriptures to do that. Then to conclude, there were two superpowers in the world, in the old world. Those superpowers were not America and the Soviet Union. They were the Byzantine Empire, and Egypt was a Byzantine nation, and Persia. In the 7th century, they were fighting each other. It was a time of weakness for them after many wars. Egypt was a Christian nation, the superpower of the Middle East. And in a time of weakness, Arabs from the Arabian Peninsula came through the Sinai and took over Egypt. Some of the Egyptian Copts who didn't like their leaders said, "Come in, we don't like our leaders." And they took over by the sword. They entered the churches, the ancient churches. Egypt was a Christian nation for 600 years. They got the preachers, put them upside down in front of the people, and started cutting their arms and legs to force the people to convert to Islam, or those who couldn't. Most of them did at the end. They didn't want the preachers killed. And what they did was, the ones who could afford, only the rich people could afford the jizya, and they paid it and remained as Christians. This should be a lesson to all of us, that a superpower can be taken over. It can be taken over, and we have a free nation, a democracy that protects the rights of everybody. But is Islam a religion that orders the murder and killing of others? Only non-members should survive and non-members should be killed? The way Islam came to being in the 7th century was a rejection of Christianity and Judaism. They wanted to preserve their Arabian culture and their habits and their male power and polygamy. They didn't want Christianity because this was a warring culture. It was a tribal Bedouin warring culture. For them to adopt Christianity, they must undergo a very major social and cultural reformation. They were at a crossroads. Do we convert? Some of them did. And Muhammad came, preserved the Arabian warring tribal culture. Superiority to men over women, oppression of women. Islam kept slavery. Slavery is still part of Islam until today. They didn't want to get rid of their slaves. They didn't want to get rid of their oppression of women. And they created a religion against the true religion. And that's why until today, Islam is scared, very scared of Jesus Christ. And we must, in America, preserve and strengthen our faith, because this is the only way we won't be penetrated by this evil ideology. Thank you very much.
This has been God, Gaza, and Israel, presented by Noni Darwish. To receive a free catalog of over 200 awesome Stealing the Mind Bible studies on DVDs, CDs, or audio tape, information on upcoming Bible conferences in your area, or details of our missionary outreach and trips to Israel, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 24 hours a day or on the web at compass.org.